Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert? How are you?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like Frankenstein.
What?
Like the monster that is Frankenstein. And it's a kind of indirect but connected reference, because when I first met today's guest, it was back in those pre-pandemic days. It was literally about 2 months before the pandemic began. And he had emailed me as a then student at Goldsmiths, and he was about to graduate and do his master's show. And he asked me to go in and do tutorials. And I think the teaching group there had said that the artist could actually select who they wanted to visit. And I think it was the early days of Talk Art, and today's guests had been listening and being very supportive. So I went in and I met a number of artists, including another guest lecturer that day, who was Lindsay Mendick. And today's guest is actually the person we've realised who hooked me up with Lindsay Mendick and changed my life on that level. The work when I first met today's guest was all about resuscitation and really breath, and not just the breath of the artist, because the artist does amazing performances and as well as making sculptures and installations. Back then, particularly, he was doing these performances with breath and like breathing life into the sculptures. And also the visitors were encouraged to breathe as part of the work. And I was really obsessed with that idea at the time, this idea of material being our own breath, you know, within our lungs, and how that's somehow an art material. I'd never thought about it that much. Mm. And at the time, it made me think a bit about Matthew Barney and Mariko Mori. And there were numerous artists that I saw, even Mike Kelly, maybe. They were kind of artists who created these worlds and often had very particular framing and installation methods that I felt this guest had really specifically sort of found his own language. And growing up in kind of post-communist Poland, that was also a really big influence on the work. So right now they have a show at Queer Circle in London. Many years have passed and they've grown and grown and grown with rapid speed, actually, and really become the artist I could see they were the kind of early seeds of when I first met them. They've really become the artist already in a very few years. So it's been very exciting to witness that growth. And we're very proud and excited to welcome to Talk Art Raphael Zyko.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Raph.
Thank you for having me. Nice to hear you. Nice to see you.
I'm yeah. So glad we're doing this at last. It's like full circle moment.
Yeah, no, it's happening, and it's. I'm glad you're remembering those works with the breath and breathing, because I felt like they were kind of quite important works for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they really led to where you've gone to. Can we quickly talk about those then? Because I was really impressed at the time about the actual production level as well of the sculptures. It was very like, you know, formed through, I don't know, like how did you make those sculptures?
I mean, it was all kind of, you know, learning how to do certain things online, you know, kind of blowing the acrylics and literally blowing the smoke as well in the works. But how it came about, I was just like, because I came from a kind of performative background, I've been doing lots of performances back in the past, and when I started doing kind of sculptures and kind of things on the wall, I started finding them a little bit kind of too static. And I started missing this kind of performative element in them. And then basically, you know, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. And I thought this thing about, you know, the breathing life into something as it's kind of giving it a life. And I thought, what about just connecting, you know, my own breath to the works, but how I can do it so the breath is visible. So I was using I was using vapes, you know, I was using vapes and using the smoke that was kind of going to the circuitry of the works and coming out from the different holes and from the work. And after that, I came with the idea of using the acrylic domes that basically, you know, they were kind of maintaining the smoke while it was kind of coming out and filling up. So, that's when we met, when I was doing those works. And that was, as you mentioned, just before the pandemic.
And also, you were one of the first artists I ever saw to mention the word vape. And I remember asking you at the time, because I'm not a smoker, and I remember vapes being part of the work and this concept of like how something that's so frowned upon, which is smoking for our health and all those reasons, had kind of been repackaged and made like science fiction-y and kind of like a different material as a vape.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, like, look at Landeray now. I mean, like, Landeray is all about the vape, you know. But I think, but I think then also for me, it was like the work was made high spec by me. But for example, I still couldn't work out how to use the smoke machines connecting to the work. So I thought like, okay, I'm gonna use basically a vape. So I was making those works when I was basically standing behind the wall with the vape, and all the people thought there were some machines that pumping this pumping this smoke in, but there was me just breathing it in and then kind of like sucking it out slowly. So it feels like there was some mechanics happening there, but it was just just me.
That feels like it actually sums up your kind of practice, is this like man and machine feel. And it's like you are a massive fan of technology when you look at your work, but yet you like to use your hands. And I love this idea that people are looking at these sculptures of yours, which are so beautifully rendered at times. They're really elegant, this sort of vacuum formed acrylic. And then you're behind it. It's a bit Wizard of Oz. Do you know what I mean? You're Oz behind it. You pull the curtain back and you're there blowing all the smoke out. But in reality, you're looking at it and it's this sort of performance, this mirage of what you're being shown. And so it's a man, a machine and technology. They're a huge element to the practice. How did technology become something for you that you then were channeling into art?
I think it's just my upbringing, you know. I'm like kind of, you know, working class Polish boy, you know. Like I was raised by my grandparents, you know, who basically worked in a fabric factory in Poland, which the factory slowly kind of declined in the 90s, you know. But I remember when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time after school because there was no one to look after me. And so I sat there and look at them working those big, it was a fabric factory, so those big jacquard machines, you know, producing the fabrics and weaving. And I just observed those people, you know, lines and like hundreds of those machines, like choreography between them, people, the machines, their fingers, you know, the spools of the threads coming out. And I suppose, and that was just like, you know, when you're growing up, you're seeing that. And then on Sunday, you're being pulled to the church and you're seeing this performative thing of the church, you know what I mean? Like, and then the second part of the family work in the fields and you see the kind of the field machines. And also, so I kind of feel like those three things, oddly enough, the church as well is a part of this mechanism that kind of got embedded in my head, you know, like there were those kind of formative things of people coming together and being in a place and kind of working, you know. So
so after school you would go, so your family worked in different factories, you had textile factories, you had like agriculture, were really part of like there's I've read that there's a big primeval forest that you were living near. You had the church, so you had all of these elements sort of you've drawn on.
Absolutely. And it's kind of, that's what I said, I'm going to say it again, once a Catholic always Catholic, those things just stay with you, you know. Sometimes you kind of like, you look at the work and you're just like, oh my goodness, you know, I know where is it coming from.
So how did these what was the Catholic imagery? Why is that something that has stayed with you?
I don't know. I think it's not about imaginary, but what you were imagining happening. You know, when you're in a church and it's saying this is the moment that there is a Lamb of God appearing in front of you and the bread's turning into the body. So there's this kind of like mechanical change of the liquid, which is wine that's turning into blood. You know, it's like science, you know. So I think like already then I was like interested in those kind of mechanisms, which like now I'm using, you know, synthetic sweat and synthetic urine in some of the works and breath, you know. So I think this kind of, that's connection to the kind of the machines and the church is kind of existing somehow alongside each other.
Synthetic urine is something I'm really interested in, because I understand that this urine is used for people who want to pass drug tests when they're not going to pass with their own urine.
Yes, basically.
So they're able to buy this synthetic urine. And that actually works and can get you cleared.
Yes, but what's kind of amazing about it is, specifically how this came about was when I was working on my degree show then, and basically I was doing the work about the wheat and how our human bodies not digesting kind of gluten and stuff, and then alongside that, I wanted to do something with urine in the work as a kind of digestion. But that was after I saw the Andy Warhol's piece paintings, and I saw how the copper patina kind of appears on the kind of, you know, copper surfaces after urine's going on it. But because it was pandemic, and because also I think using your own urine in the work is a little bit kind of too carnal, and too kind of like, I felt it's a bit kind of naff, I was like, let's see if something like synthetic urine exists. And then I just found this whole kind of business of those kind of companies producing it. And most importantly, so I just bought a little bit of it first, and I just checked if that's going to react with the copper. And it reacted in the same way as the real urine would react on the copper. Wow. So what I did for the degree show, I had those sculptures where the tops of those kind of sculptures were made from this frozen synthetic urine that was slowly melting into this kind of like a urinal-like kind of bit in the middle of the body, and then dripping on copper and kind of oxidizing it. But what is interesting about it is that the synthetic urine business is, because those companies now know that synthetic urine exists, so they're making the tests are kind of tighter and tighter. And when they're making the tighter and tighter tests, the synthetic urine is even more like human-like. So there's this really weird battle between those. Yeah, it's kind of weird things happening behind the scenes, you know?
It's also really sci-fi, though. Like a bit like when I mentioned Frankenstein and that idea of like resuscitating a body or bringing a body to life from dead body parts or something.
In that
kind of sci-fi story. Have you always been interested in that kind of thing? Like these kind of tales?
I think so. I think it was always kind of there with me. I don't know, mythology. I mean, like really often I respond to mythology titles for the works and particularly, you know, I mean, like you mentioning the kind of the Frankenstein. I mean, like that was also that show that kind of never opened. So that was when we met, when I kind of made that show called Resuscitation, which basically was kind of this room with this kind of sarcophagus in orange, kind of, it was called an amber chamber. And inside of it, I had this character called Hochul, you know, and he was kind of like my version of the Frankenstein because that character Hochul was from this Polish book. And he was basically, he was the thing that people see in the, like in the fields, not the, what you call the ones in Britain, the ones in the field.
Like a scarecrow.
Yeah, but in Poland, they're the ones which are kind of, they're kind of chunkier. And from afar, they look like people, but they're not meant to be. So basically, there was this character in this book that it was this kind of straw bale kind of coming alive and kind of punishing people for not kind of dealing with the nature in the right way, you know, kind of doing some kind of stuff that it's kind of bad for nature anyways. So it was human.
But also like folklore as well, though, and like the maypole dancing and all that kind of thing. I remember the first time I met you with Karen Smith at her house, who's an amazing collector in London and philanthropist. I remember you telling me about like maypole dancing and even the costumes to do with that,
and how
folklore was also a kind of another one of these many threads that were woven into your work.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of the weird one, because like in the region, which is so kind of like, as I said, so kind of Catholic, so kind of industrial, that there is like still so much kind of like pagan kind of beliefs kind of embedded into it. So we've got like a lot of fortune tellers, like all the ladies which are like 70s and 80s, which are kind of like they barely walk, but they still kind of do the fortune telling, and the people kind of queuing for like hours to get to them, or like healers called whisperers, and the whisperers are those kind of ladies which are kind of like going to your ear and kind of with the sound of the voice, they're kind of taking things out of you, you know. And
what's that? I want to know about this. They take things out of you.
Yeah, like your soul rust.
It's a bit like Little Mermaid.
Not like a diseases, and that's no joke. There is this really famous one, and called Orla Whisperer. And basically we went to kind of see that place. It was like maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago when I was in Poland. We went for like little kind of ride around the region. And there is a queue of the cars going for like a village outside of the village. There's like hundreds of people queuing for the days. And she's just basically, you know, getting people in. She's getting children first, you know, like, but then older people later. And when we arrived, there was this guy who kicked off because he was waiting for 2 days basically camping to be seen. And then there was someone taken in front of him who was behind him, and he started to kick off. And she just came out of the house. Everything went quiet. She pointed a finger at him and she said to him, like, you just go. Like, it was just like, you know, it was just the air stood still, and I'm just not telling. It's just like, so the things like that, you know, it's that's what I said. It was a weird kind of place to be growing up with.
We can't just get over this. So this woman was, what was she actually doing, and were people like recovering from whatever was wrong with
they were recovering, like the migraines, the things that kind of the doctors couldn't sort out. Like, that's, you know, even my grandmother, kind of when she was younger, she kind of went then cured, and she was kind of cured of the massive migraines that she had, and no one could have helped her with, you know what I mean? Like, so it's a
Orla still alive? Is she still there?
And but then also there are those kind of the new ones that she's apparently calling, and they're having the calling from the different regions in Poland, and they're just coming and kind of learning the kind of the craft. And
I'm obsessed with this. So do you think this is all because of this primeval forest?
I think so. I think so. But also there's like a lot of stuff like in Catholicism, I know in the religion, that basically it comes from a pagan beliefs that they were there before the Catholicism. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there's a lot of kind of this thing. That's why it's kind of those things kind of intertwine in an odd way, you know?
In your bios, it describes your work, and it says that you're inspired by the industrial past, exploring its environmental impact in relation to working class heritage and queer identities. Mm-hmm. Let's break that down then. So for people working out the work. So the industrial past we've talked about, which is like what you were experiencing as a kid in Poland with both your families being in textiles and agriculture, and the environmental impact that this has had on you and your sort of approach to the world, but also the world at large.
That's what I'm kind of thinking. I mean, like, that's like, even, you know, with the kind of the current show that, you know, we're speaking here about, you know, at the queer circle, I feel like the kind of the show is a bit of my kind of observation, my kind of commentary on the kind of what's happening kind of in the world now through my personal story. Kind of, I'm trying to kind of speak about the kind of the broader kind of conversations. And I suppose even, you know, me thinking about the works, and, you know, particularly the work in the middle, which is this big kind of pendulum called kind of Sisyphus, and kind of how this kind of came about. It was for me basically thinking about, you know, how the kind of the politics keep on kind of changing, and, you know, and how it kind of goes from the left to the right, and like how, you know, we've been fighting for some things, our rights being revoked. And, you know, so there's this kind of, there's this kind of connection. That's how I was kind of thinking about it. But then kind of in my head, I like to think that, you know, the progress is not linear, you know, and sometimes we need to go a little back to kind of go further, or, you know, sometimes we're knocked back. So I know, I suppose that's the kind of the reading kind of that piece. And and also, you know, once it's called after Sisyphus, you know, and the Sisyphus was the guy who was pushing this big rock on a mountain, and the moment he was reaching the top, the rock was rolling back down. It was his kind of like eternal punishment. So I almost feel like, you know, all our fights that we're doing, they can be taken back, or it almost feels like we need to start and do it again. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's a, and that's what I think, you know, about, I know, you know, I mean, like the, you know, the queer rights is the one thing, but, you know, but the women rights in Poland, you know, I mean, like, that's what's kind of, it's even, you know, getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, even in terms of the kind of the election at the moment in Poland, you know, there is like the media portrays that there is no support towards the kind of the left wing anymore. You know what I mean? Like, which actually there was like a million people on the streets, and they just show in the video there is no one there, you know, and it's really becoming kind of bonkers.
Well, it's a global thing, isn't it? This move towards the far right. I think even Russ was protesting on the weekend in London, you know, against our government too. It's just, it's really hideous. I like that idea though of the pendulum, and because I always thought about it in a really literal sense as part of a clock, and I was wondering whether it was to do with time, because I feel like so much of your work is to do with time, but it's interesting that it's to do with political shifts.
But that's also kind of when you kind of start working on the show and on the things, I mean, like, you know you're starting from one point, but then you kind of loads of different kind of points appearing across the time, you know, and it's you know, I mean, like, I started producing it kind of thinking kind of on the back burner, you know, kind of to respond to that kind of factory of my grandparents, you know, and, you know, remembering that line that goes across the show, which was basically, you know, they use this kind of particular paint, which is on a certain level, that basically the workers who mostly got the greasy hands, you know, all their hand marks can be really easily wiped out, you know what I mean? Like, and I thought about it in the connection of, like, I don't know, our marks being wiped out, the borders, you know, there's all of those kind of things that you kind of keep on thinking, you know, and also use of that color, this green. It's like, you know, think about it, it's like that particular green was used in the factories because it soothes people, it kind of calms people down. So there's this kind of use of the kind of weaponizing the architecture to make people calm down, but also kind of in our ancestral kind of mind, the green line, you think about the fields. So there's like, it not only the color suits you down, but also kind of makes you think you're outside somewhere back in your kind of subconscious, you know. So it's like all of those kind of mechanisms, I suppose.
We were visiting a cruise ship recently, me and Rob, and we went into the captain's quarters where all the, you know, the machinery is to actually drive the cruise ship, and that's all painted that green as well, and that's to keep everyone calm and it keeps you awake apparently, and also in hospital wards they have that
as well. It's meant to be for alertness and clarity of thinking. Apparently it's the one color that will keep you consistently clear-headed.
It's like a mossy green, isn't it?
But I think, you know, I mean like well, we're going to speak about the color later, but I mean like the thing about this particular color also is, I mean like, that's what it makes me think. Also it makes me think about the nurse's outfits, makes me think about the makes me think about the health, but also historically, which I kind of, that's why I kind of liked it, and I used that kind of shades of that color before, even in that resuscitation show, was also used in Victorian times by the fashionistas they were using arsenic to get that color on the dresses. So basically, when the ladies were wearing the dresses in that color, which was really fashionable, they were getting ill and they were getting basically poisoned by it. So that's like a kind of first kind of, you know, British kind of fashion victims kind of situation.
But really, fashion victims, how long were they wearing? How long did this last before people correlated the clothes they were wearing were poisoning them?
I think the kind of the reports are saying that people knew that it's bad for them, but because it was fashionable, so they were kind of still kind of wanted to do
my
it.
God.
But anyways, that's a little trivia.
I think what I'm drawn to in your work as well is this feeling of nostalgia, yet very kind of forward thinking. It reminds me of the Jetsons, the way that people in the 60s would have assumed the future would look like, you know, and when they were making that cartoon. And then there's this sort of 60s Italian sort of like vibe. And the palette you use is quite sickly at times. I mean, it's like bright, but it has this sort of anxiety to it, to the color palette, and how you bring all these elements together has always been so fascinating to me, because these things are unlike anything else we really see. But yet they have this nostalgic. You feel like you recognize them, but
yet there's a familiarity, isn't there?
But yet they're so new. Alien. Yeah, they feel like they're alien. That's a sci-fi thing, I guess, in some ways.
Well, I suppose, but I mean, like, I think, as I said, because kind of my upbringing was a little bit different to, like, I know my kind of contemporaries here, you know, and it's like saying about the culture arriving a little bit later in a bit of a different kind of way, but also not having, I don't know, access to, you know, technology like computers and things like that, because we could never afford it, you know. I got myself a first computer after I moved to UK. I had my first job and I earned my first money and I got my computer. And the first thing which I did was, you know, downloading the games that my friends used to have on the computer when I was a child. So I could play them for myself. I don't want to kind of give some cheesy stories, but as I said, like this connection to technology, kind of, I kind of got it a little bit kind of later.
It must have felt amazing though, then, if you sort of manifested that. You watched your friends play these games, you didn't have access to them yourself, and then as soon as you got the computer, you're able to go
back. I can go back and I can just do it in my own time, although I'll be kicked out by somebody's mom saying, okay, can he just go home now, you know, for too long.
What were the games?
I don't know. I mean, you know, probably my favorite one was like Tomb Raider. I mean, like, come on, you know, it's just, you know, it's kind of pretty camp and fun. But anyways, and I suppose, you know, coming back to, as you said, this kind of things about the colors and the kind of the things being kind of sickly and kind of nostalgic, I think also it comes to, you know, we haven't had our first color TV until we were like 11 or something, you know, when I was 11. And I just remember when the first color TV arrived and it had this logo on the side called Biaset, and it had this like red, green and blue kind of colored circles, you know what I mean, like, and then the name of the company. And I just remember I just put my head really close to the TV. I was like, how is red, green and blue create the white light, you know? So I was just putting my head really close, putting my eyes to that, and then, you know, just seeing those little nobules of the light creating the white light. And I think this kind of like red, green and blue kind of thing, this trinity of colors, I often, you know, used and I'm using in my work. It's like my little kind of nod to that, I suppose. Which then also that kind of oddly, you know, connects to, as you kind of notice, you know, some sort of in my research, you know, like the Italian kind of like aesthetic as well. So it's not only kind of like Polish post-Soviet, but also I think there is loads of kind of different kind of pockets, like from a different kind of you can see cultures, I mean, like from a different kind of areas, which I think I'm kind of trying to merge in the work, you know.
But I think that plays out with the materials you choose as well, because if you look at the work, there's so much involved. There's ceramics, there's ventilation kind of systems, prosthetics. As I said, there's like these vacuum form bits, there's piping, there's wires, there's, as you said, smoke. At one point you used ice in something. I mean, the fact is that you bring so many different materials in together. And also you've said that you celebrate acquiring new skill sets. And like every time you kind of create a body of work, it's like you then acquire a whole new skill set of how to bring and put these things together. It's brilliant. What's the latest skill set you've like acquired through your practice?
I always think of you, Rafael, as being like someone in a workshop. Mm. Like I can kind of imagine you there, like
tinkering away.
Exactly.
In your own shed at the bottom of the garden.
Also, Russell, you forgot to mention synthetic sweat as well.
Oh, yes, I always forget to mention that.
And also, you do. I've never even heard of it. Yeah. I want to chat about that one too. Yeah. And also melted candles, like church candles.
Yeah, I mean, like that's... I feel like in this clocking off kind of show, as I said, you know, I mean, like from the title of it, you know, which kind of coming out from this idea of clocking out, you work in a factory, clocking out at the end, you're leaving. So there's this kind of idea of the surveillance and kind of your time somewhere is being measured, you know? So it's like where I kind of feel like our time's now being measured all the time. I feel like we're on the clock all the time. We're aware of the things that are kind of happening around us and stuff. So where the melted church candle came around together with the synthetic sweat is that basically, you know, the figure and the figures that you see in the show, they kind of got this kind of slightly kind of reminiscent of the kind of beehive or a bobbin, you know, and there's this connection of like of the what human body excrete, which is the sweat, and then the production of the bees, which is the wax, but then the connection to the church through the melted church candles that I managed to acquire from the set swap cycle. Someone was getting rid of literally bags and bags and bags of like church candles, and I was like, yes please, and you know, and I'm kind of using it a lot in the work now, and it's
so it's sustainable as well, all of your practice.
I mean I'm trying as much as I can, you know. It's you know, I mean, like you're aware of those things.
Well, let's go back to the Queer Circle show then, because this is a show clocking off that we can go into that more. So the Queer Circle is a free space. It's an LGBT-led charity. It works at an intersection of arts, health and social action, and it champions LGBTQI+ artists. I myself am on the board of trustees, so I know it very, very well. Mm-hmm. And your show there called Clocking Off has just opened. And it's, as you said, it's like an imagined, abstracted factory floor with this soft green moss there and this metronome that is called Sisyphus. This show is amazing. And this huge kinetic pendulum that you have in the middle of the space is so... enthralling and terrifying at the same time. And what? How did this show come about, and how has it been received?
Yeah, I mean, like Ashley was one of the people who actually visited my degree show, and
this is Ashley who runs the space.
Ashley Joyner, you know, and then we haven't really been. We didn't know each other then, but then kind of he told me like later that he thought when he's going to get a physical space, he was thinking that I was the one of the first artists he would like to kind of work with. And, you know, and it's been an absolute joy. And I think, you know, before I'm, you know, I mean, like, we can speak about the work, but I think for me, what was exciting, because, you know, it took me quite a while to install the show. And there was this one Sunday I was there installing, you know, doing bits, painting, checking if everything is done, you know, to the millimeter, being kind of quite precise. But also that was the day when there was a kind of the workshop of the kind of the queer youth. And, you know, there were the kind of the people coming around, which were kind of age, I think, 16 to 20 or something like that. And I was the only person downstairs. So I was kind of like during the doors for them when they were coming around, and just to kind of to see, there was like 30 or 40 of them that day, and just to see all this kind of like, you know, the new generation, all this like young people having the space and having the community that early in their life, you know, and just to have the support. I mean, that's something that, you know, that you could not have imagined. I mean, I definitely would have imagined that, you know, myself kind of thinking I was the only kind of, well, I mean, like you knew a few other people, but like, you know, that you just didn't have that, you know, when you're growing up, when you were that age, you know, and that's just going to, you know, help them with the kind of growth. And anyways, it's been, I was kind of getting emotional there. I was just like, oh my God, I got to sort of hug all of them. I was just like so excited, you know, just to see that it exists. So it's just nice to kind of, you know, be given a space to show, you know, my work kind of alongside such a great kind of programming and, you know, any other things, you know. So
So what was it like being growing up gay in Bialystok in Poland then?
Well, I mean, like it was, you know, I mean, like, you know, you knew about the other kind of, gay people I know from a gossip, you know, that someone might be, and that
all of them might have told you.
Yeah, or someone kind of told you and stuff. But then kind of you weren't really kind of sticking with them, because if you had two gay people friends, they know that. Do you know what I mean? Like you almost kind of give. It's been really, you know, it's been quite a tough kind of situation. But also in the same time, I don't know. It's kind of I still managed to find my people. You know, I still managed to kind of find the way kind of around it. And even though it was kind of like quite secretive, I kind of feel like it makes you appreciate things more now. You know. And it's definitely, I mean, like, would I change anything about my upbringing? I don't think so, you know? I think it's, I mean, like, it's created, it made me the person I am. So I think for that reason, I think it's, I still found it a valuable kind of experience, you know?
Just to was make, there an art community that you found? Or what, you know, was there museums or galleries?
No. So my community was a nightclub called Metro. And that was like one of the most kind of like famous clubs for electronic music in Poland, in my odd little city. But because they had such a good lineup of the DJs coming from all over the world, you know what I mean? Like, I was going there since I was 14. And I was like a kind of platinum member when I was 16. When I was 18, when I realized I was going there for the last 4 years and I was illegal, they just gave me a ban for a month because they thought I was much older than I was. I was going there all my life. So that was my community, you know, because you had people coming from kind of, even though I was from this quite a small kind of city, town, you know, you had people coming from all over the world, you know, different DJs, like different kind of culture, you know. So that was my kind of the window to the West, and I could see and hear from their stories what is out there, you know. And I think, you know, I knew I'm not gonna stay in Poland. You know, I knew like the moment I finish and I've got, you know, the right qualifications, I knew I'm gonna go abroad and I'm gonna try to, you know, find the education there, you know, and kind of try to progress on the path.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
what do your family think of you now living in London as an artist and making a living and thriving?
Yeah, I mean, like, kind of my family kind of, you know, really kind of crumbled after, you know, my grandmother and grandfather passed away, you know. So I mean, like, always the elders are the gel of the kind of the family, but my granny was the, you know, she was the biggest champion, you know. Like, when I was moving to UK, I mean, like, you know, she took the loan from the bank so I can move here. I can't believe, honestly, when I think about it now, I moved to London with 500 quid.
You were 19, right?
I was 19. I moved to London. Wow. I moved to London with 500 quid. I managed to find a job in 2 days as a cocktail bartender. Never worked as a bartender before. Like, it's hilarious. But basically, what I did was, literally the first thing, you know, before I bought a computer, I gave back the money to my grandmother and I said, like, you know, and that was like the first thing, because I want to see, like, listen, I'm, my kind of way of saying I'm doing okay, you know, like, you can trust me, I'm doing okay. So she's not around with us for like 7 years now, but I think she's seen that the things were happening, and, you know, she didn't understood necessarily a lot of things, you know, but she was creative about, even though she was working in a fabric factory, she was making clothes, you know. So I think what I did was, that's why I started using some costumes that I made myself for my performances, because I had something to kind of bond over with her, you know. And, you know, so I think that was my kind of, you know, connection.
I'm sure she was very proud of you.
Definitely.
That's a nice thing to be able to, like, give back to the people that have given to you, especially when it's your family.
Yeah, definitely.
So leaving your mark is also something I think about a lot with your work, because obviously when we're all long gone, what is left is our culture, is the art, is the, you know, the films, the music that's made in our time.
Yeah.
And I think Russ and I both really love that idea. And it's been something that I think since I was 13, has been a real driving force for me. And there's a project you did, which you mentioned earlier, which was partly in collaboration with the Henry Moore Foundation. Mm-hmm. I think they supported it. And it was with the Wising Arts Centre, which was with a St. Peter's school in Huntingdon. Mm-hmm. And it was called We Were Here, which I thought was such a beautiful title. Mm-hmm. But there was something about that project of you working with these kids to develop a work. They even chose you, didn't they? The kids actually chose you as the artist they wanted to collaborate with.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that project?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, like, so they kind of selected me based on just, you know, the look of the work, basically. So they had a few artists and they just decided they want to work with me, which is kind of like, I mean, that's already, I'm like, that just, I've been, my heart was just like, singing. And I never kind of work with that kind of age group, you know? So I've been so stressed before the first session. I literally couldn't sleep for two nights. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to swear. I'm going to say something, you know, I'm going to use some wrong word or so. And it was, the first session was so life-changing. I can't even tell you. So I've been doing this presentation on the work, which I simplified it later. I was trying to make it simplified, but I still realized I got to simplify it later. And there was these two boys in the corner and they were like, not having it. You know, they were just like really loud, really kind of like, I was just like, oh my God, I'm in trouble. You know, I'm going to be in trouble. I finished the presentation and then one of them was like, sir, are you Polish? And I was like, oh my God, now I'm being picked up and being Polish from this student. And then I said to him like, yes, I am. And he was like, me too. And I was like, gotcha. I came to him and I said to him into his ear in Polish, I was like, listen, you're my brother. This is the first time I'm doing that. I'm really, really stressed. You need to help me out, you know? And he just kind of all of a sudden got really proud. He calmed everybody down. Like the stuff that he did that day was so amazing, because we were doing this kind of like capsules that we want to, you know, keep the things for the future. And he drew this lovely tree of the connection. And in the middle of it, he put like more personal kind of human contact or something. And I was like, is someone's like making a joke now? Is this actually really happening? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, like, I had a few of those kind of moments of different workshops with those students that, I mean, like, you know.
How old was he?
So they're year seven. So they were 11, 12 year old, you know. And
wow.
The idea of time
you,
capsules.
How amazing of you, though, to know, to like have that sort of approach with him, to have that real adult connection to go, listen, I need help, mate. Him going, okay, yeah, I'm going to man up for you. I'm going to like support you.
But I think for me, what was the key that I feel like I was naturally drawn to those students who were a little bit more difficult, you know. I just kind of felt like I had the kind of more of a kind of language with them, you know. And it's, I mean, like, also there was like, who is this weird man with a mullet coming around, you know what I mean? Like, okay, because, you know, because at the beginning of it, at the end of it, what's supposed to happen, we're supposed to do some sort of performance with the students, but then I saw all this kind of crevices in the school, that there were like those empty kind of like spaces where the fire extinguishers used to be, and I just felt architecturally they were so beautiful. And I was like, okay, that could actually have some of the work there. Maybe I can do something with the students. That's when I spoke with Rosie Cooper, who's the director of Wising. I said, listen, can we just, you know, try to squeeze some money from somewhere, and we can maybe produce some physical work that can stay in a school and kind of can come out of those kind of workshops. And that's how kind of it all kind of started, kind of snowballing. And then in the end, you know, I did my first kind of like permanent work that's actually outside of the school, and four smaller works that are in the school, which are kind of like in a direct kind of collaboration with the students. And
And that all came out of this time capsule idea as well.
No,
is that what? Because the title is "We Were Here."
We were here. Yes. Yeah. So I think it was kind of way of thinking of like what do you leave behind? What would you like to leave behind? So I was also kind of asking them to kind of imagine what sort of technology we're gonna have in the future. You know, what sort of kind of machines can be doing stuff. And that's another really good history, good story. There was this another boy who basically, this lady came to the class and she said like, oh, why he's like, she never seen him so calm. Like, he's normally like a hellraiser. I was like, okay, well, let's just give him more attention. You know, let's just go and see what he's thinking. And so I said to him, okay, so what's your invention? What are you inventing here? And he said he's inventing a machine that's going to clone meat, so clone steaks, so vegans can eat meat again, so they're not going to have a problem with that. And I was like, come on, like, you're onto something. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you give somebody kind of, I don't know, more attention, you can really kind of get amazing things out of those, you know, young brains, young people, you know. And as I said, I never done it before, and I was kind of like, you know, I've been in the arts for years, and I mean, like, it just gave me so much myself as an artist to be around that. And I feel like I just grew so much, learned how to operate in a different way, learned how to speak about the art from less pompous kind of position. Yes. And about, you know, there's no kind of like, you know, bullshit. I don't know if you can say it on the podcast with them. Because you know, if they don't like something, they just look true. They just don't care, you know?
And I love the way that you gravitated towards the rebels as well. You were like solidarity with the rebel kids.
I think I was a bit of a rebel, you know? I mean, like, even though I was a gay kid, but also I was a bit of a, you know, I was a smart, but I was naughty as well. Do you know what I mean? Like,
so, same as me, really. When we first met, you actually met Rob in a more academic front, the fact that he was critiquing your MA at Goldsmiths.
But thank you.
Click, so click, academic. Click. But for me, we met at my 40th when I was very drunk and very out of it because suddenly I walked into a room and there was a big surprise and there was like 100 people who I knew and I nearly had a panic attack. But you brought me a gift of a chewing gum pin brooch. Mm. And chewing gum has been a big element of your practice. And I'd love to hear stories about how you weave that in with these kids and how you celebrated, like, you know, when you find chewing gum under desks and stuff. Yeah. And it's kind of gross, but you've celebrated that.
Well, I think it's kind of, you know, I mean, like, it's kind of few level stories. So let's just kind of start from the beginning. You know, the use of the chewing gum kind of happened when I don't know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, when I saw the, you know, the remaining bits of the Berlin Wall in Berlin. And they're all covered in the chewing gums. And I was just like, what is it? Why is it there? And it's like, for some reason, all the people who are coming from all over the world, they're leaving the chewing gum on the remaining bits of the Berlin Wall. Like, it's thousands of the chewing gums. And then, you know, I was like, how interesting is that there are those people leaving their marks? Are they kind of like, they're kind of trying to push on that kind of old regime and kind of like shit on it. This is being disrespectful to it. But then also, you know, the chewing gum contains people's DNA. So you've got this Berlin Wall's pieces with these thousands of people chewing gums with the DNA samples from all over. It's just so bizarre, you know? So the first time I work with the chewing gum, I work on a show in my city called We Were Here. That's where this title comes from. It's like a continuation of that. And I've built this kind of big kind of column in the middle of the space, which was built from the bricks on the floor, like...
tile,
you know, outside, like a
cobble, breeze blocks, cobbles,
like, not, yeah, like, you know, the ones that you walk on, like on the streets, you know what I mean? Like,
so paving slabs,
paving slabs, but the kind of like but in the kind of shape paving slabs. Anyway, so correct. I built this kind of like a monument in the middle around the column where basically looked like a paving slab, and I gave all the visitors of the show the chewing gum. So they could just leave their mark, you know what I mean, like on that paving slab, like a monument in the middle. And I worked with this chewing gum idea for a while. And then, so the one that you've got is one of my chewing gums, like cast. It's a cast of the chewing gum. But what I did in the school was, during one of the workshops, honestly, absolutely, sorry, I just need to kind of do the shout out here to Dawn Glover. That was the teacher who kind of started everything at school, and she was the most amazing woman. I just love her. And then I said to her, okay, so listen, so can we just like ask students to chew the gum, and we're going to kind of cast it, and we're going to put it inside of those kind of sculptures in those crevices in the school? And she was like, yeah, absolutely, we can find a way. So, we, you know, it was also kind of like quite a legal thing. We need to contact the parents. I had to research the chewing gums, that there is nothing allergic related in any sort of way, you know what I mean? And it was like absolutely bonkers class, you know, because you thought everyone's going to love it. But some of the people were, that's disgusting, I'm not doing it, you know what I mean? Like, so there was this kind of really kind of quite a polarized kind of thing, but we still kind of did it. And and one of the slabs with their chewing gums is now embedded in one of the works that's actually in the school as a permanent work.
Who were the ones, if you're talking about gender, this was a mixed gender class.
Yeah.
So would you, you know, were the boys up for it and the girls not? Could it be as binary as that?
Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, like, you would imagine, no, I think some of the boys were just, no.
Really?
no. So it's been actually, I don't know. I feel like with this kind of, you know, I mean, like, I've seen the kind of, I work with this kind of younger generation. I think the thing's really changing. I don't know. I think perhaps because younger kids got the kind of access to culture also a little bit earlier, and they see the kind of the different things that are possible to exist within. I think it's, you know, some kids are clicking on the quite early, you know, that you can kind of operate in different ways, you know.
within this practice, there's something as well within these works I've seen, is your love of pebbling, which is something that I have discovered you love and I love.
Okay.
Can you talk? Do you still go pebbling?
I'm just so happy you're saying that, because I was kind of thinking how I'm going to be able to mention someone who I love the most in the world in here, except my partner, Jonathan Baldock, but it's his mum, who's like my mum in here in Britain. Aww. You know, Irene Winter. Hi, I love you so much. And basically, so that's my, basically, we often go on those kind of little short breaks with John's mum and Irene. And then, we just go pebbling. We're looking for those stones with the holes in. You know, they've got this
derogatory. You go to Dungeness, right?
We go to Dungeness. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just like, there is something about, I don't know, I'm a workaholic, you know, I think that's from the kind of generation of the workers, you know, I feel bad when I don't work. So I feel like, even when I relax, I feel like I need to do something that reminisces some sort of labor. So for me to spend the day, you know, for 6-7 hours, you know, just on the beach, looking for those pebbles, select, let's say, 30, and then you're making this kind of decision at the end of the day, which one is the one that you keep? The rest is going.
You only keep one?
Yeah, from the day. So there's this kind of quite a, but it also works for your kind of visual kind of, for your understanding of the visual. And so some things that are non-verbal, why are you making that decision? Why are you being drawn to something? Perhaps that kind of more kind of magical and some sort of kind of like...
Well, they've got lovely names, haven't they? Like there's the Adder Stone, or there's the Mermaid's Tears, which is when you find like sea glass.
Absolutely.
Or sea pottery. So each of you would select one out of the three of you, Jonathan and his mum.
Oh no, they're collecting ones for me actually, because I'm the one who's obsessed actually. So the Irene, she's like, you know, she's the one who's always coming, do you like this one? I was like, I like it. So actually, yeah, I've got more than I can handle, you know. So it's but it's a really lovely activity to do.
I want,
you know,
to do it. I just I know, the idea of it sounds amazing.
I know a family who live near a beach, and they have that as like a family tradition that's gone on for like different generations, where they all pick a certain type of shell when they're walking on the beach, and it becomes a thing that they teach the young grandchildren and everything, and it becomes this kind of beautiful thing about appreciating nature.
Well, Hannah Lees, you know, does it as well, doesn't she, with her family, Jet Lavender, and they find bits of like plastic
Hannah
that's
Lees.
Been washed up and stuff on the beach, and then that incorporates into the art. So again, it's
goes
a sort
into
of
the art, yeah.
sustainable sort of energy that goes into it, but these so things beautiful. That have existed, and then you give them new life and new narratives. Mm-hmm.
And actually, Raphael, you were talking about your partner, Jonathan Baldock, who's also a previous talk art guest. And I also know you as a duo, because you've even stayed in my house when we had that crazy party. But what is it like being partnered with another artist? Is that something that brings you joy?
Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, if it wouldn't be for John, I probably wouldn't be in the art education, because I met him and I didn't even know where to start. And then I said, you know, I'm doing those little drawings, I'm doing those little things. And, you know, he helped me to, you know, to do my, you know, application to Central St. Martin's, then for foundation, you know, and everything kind of started then. So, you know, so I've been around his work all my kind of, you know, adult life, really. And it's just, and I think it's, I mean, like, it's amazing, because I feel like, you know, I'm going to his studio and each time I'm just being like, how? How he can kind of produce, how he can come up with something new, something like that, you know? And it's just like, this absolutely kind of beautiful kind of visual language, attention to detail. It's just like, you know, it's, I think we really, there's, you know, there's so many
you
kind
both
of.
You both share that attention to detail. Though,
yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's the kind of the working classness thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't matter from which country, you know, you carry that thing and, you know, you work hard and we know. And as I said, we were just saying, like, why we're not like one of those people who just, you know, can relax and have a day off and don't feel guilty. I feel guilty when I'm taking a day off. John's the same. I mean, like, that's the thing. Yeah. It feels like someone's gonna take it away from you. You know what I mean? Like, and it's just like, yeah. But saying about the John, I mean, like, you know, he also can be really harsh, you know, about the work, and, you know, and that hurts the most. But it's also the best thing that you can get, you know. So it's just like, you know, you don't want to have someone kind of sugarcoating stuff for you, you know.
Honest
just like,
critique.
Oh,
yeah.
I love it. Bring it on. You know, I'm kind of always, you know, I've got so much respect to his practice. You know, so sometimes I'm kind of scared to say that, you know, John, actually, maybe, you know, but I think we're looking at each other like an equals, you know what I mean? Like, and we're both doing kind of things, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's really kind of lovely now to see that John does take the take advice or take something from it. That I feel like really privileged when those moments happen, that, you know, I could have helped with something or suggested something. And, you know, it's magical, you know.
Yeah. Well, I can see there's a real discourse between both your practices, knowing that you're partners and then looking at the works. You can see just the color palette, for example, there's definitely a real sort of connection that you two have, even though your work is very different. The sculptural element is very fundamental to both of your practices.
Definitely.
Which is beautiful. And, you know, and obviously sounds like there's a lot of love in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we get into final questions, I want to talk about another artist, which is an artist which I'm recently sort of really delving deep into, is Lee Bontecou, who do you know her work?
I mean, why did you say that? Because that's my heist.
Oh, is it? Okay. Well, I've leaked ahead. Well, okay. We can talk about the heist. But this is an artist I know a bit about. And then I had dinner with Annie, who runs the Hammer Museum. And she was telling me this incredible story about Lee Bontecou, who was an artist she loved. And then she just disappeared. She just went off grid for many, many, many years, but kept making work. And she sort of then rediscovered her years later. And Lee Bontecou said, oh, I'm still making work. And then opened up these warehouses full of all of this incredible, all these abstract machine-like forms that she makes. And she's telling me a story, and I was like, I need to know all about this woman. The work is incredible. Mm. Can you tell us a bit about this woman's art?
I mean, like, I've been such a big fan. I mean, like, you know, her story was, you know, she started in the 60s. She was like the only woman in the kind of the crowds of the boys, you know. She was like with this big, big gallery of the Le Castelli, you know. She was one of, you know, the ones, you know, with Sol Lewis, with all of those, like, she was there, and her work was being kind of treated on the kind of almost on the same level. But then the thing started happening that people kind of started kind of, the critics started going for her work, because she does those big voids in her work with the kind of, with the teeth and stuff. And people started saying that it's kind of,
it's very space-like.
Very space-like, but people started saying that it's kind of started reminiscing some sort of female body and stuff. And she just, she was just not having it. And she was just kind of had enough of her work being flattened to her being a female, you know? And she was just like, you know, I'm going, bye, you know? And then she was living in a farm, producing all this amazing, amazing work, you know? And
but not for anyone, just for herself.
Just for herself. Just for herself. But it's just, you know, there's just so many old materials she used. She kind of was painting with soot, you know, and because she discovered when she was welding that if you're going to remove the kind of the oxygen, it produces the black soot. So she was using this on a, it's just gorgeous. And I never seen her work until I was in Guggenheim. And it was like a pilgrimage. I was just like, it's just one of those artists that, like, why we never had any of her work in UK. You know, there's one piece in Stockholm in the museum. And I think there is something in Netherlands, like one piece somewhere. But I mean, like, bring on the retrospective or something, because that kind of artist, I mean, like, come on. Like,
was it a survey show at the Guggenheim? Well, or was it?
No, it was just one piece. I've never seen more than that, you know. But I'm like, you know, the show of the artist like that could really kind of, like, inspire the next generation. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just, you know, when you kind of got those kind of Tate shows that, like, boof, just make a kind of wave. And I feel like that could be, hint, hint, Tate.
Is it a bit like Clifford Still, where, like, a lot of the work was just kept? So is it owned by her estate?
No,
because she died in 2022.
No, she only just died last year. So I think she kind of started having retrospectives and stuff like that in the last kind of five, kind of 6 years, you know. So it's but it's like one of those kind of artists. I mean, like Titian Sue, you know, like, also he wasn't around for a while and now kind of resurfaced. So that, you know, they're having Titian Sue. He's one of the other ones that I really like. So he was making work like in kind of like in 80s and then kind of disappeared, but now kind of resurfacing. And there's a few of those kind of artists who are kind of the seniors who are kind of, you know, kind of had that moment at the later stage and got kind of discovered. Amazing. And
So as you know, we ask every guest if they could do an imaginary art heist, what artwork would you take? Obviously, you said it's the artist you've just been talking about. But can you tell us which work?
I know, but that's the thing. I can't tell you which work because they're all called Untitled. So I can kind of describe you one. I think what I would go for, I think she did this. She did this kind of like different body of work where she was making those vacuum formed flowers. And I kind of felt like my partner was doing lots of work around the flowers recently. So I thought I would just get Lee Bontecou, big. They were like 2.5 meters huge, made out of kind of early plastic vacuum form in 60s. I mean, like absolute heaven.
Oh, yeah, that's
yeah,
so cool.
I think none of them survived really. But like, I mean, because like, I think that's the reason, because they just don't, I think, exist. And I would like to see how they actually would look in flesh.
That's a great photo though. So untitled flower sculpture, 1968 vacume
yeah,
form.
Yeah, so they're
post that on the feed.
Yeah, they're
that's beautiful. I've never seen
absolutely
that.
Absolutely gorgeous. And
her work, Rob, her work is just I've recently rediscovered.
I've seen some of the work, but I've never seen the flowers.
Like, I've recently discovered Susan Rothenberg, who's an artist I'm completely obsessed now, and then Lee Bontecue. There's all these incredible artists that, you know, that's the whole reason why we keep doing talk art, because it just unravels. You just open a little door and you go, I mean, oh my God, what's through here?
And if you tap into it, it's just, you know, it's just never ending, you know? And it's never
ending. We've loved opening the little door into Raphael's mind.
We love it. What's your favourite colour?
Well, but that's the thing. I was kind of thinking. I think it's going to be copper patina.
With synthetic urine on
it? I think it's going to be copper patina, because copper patina kind of has a bit of kind of rust in it, but also has a bit of turquoise. So I've got this kind of like, you know, mechanical decline and something kind of nature-like in it. And I think I quite like that, you know, the mixture of the both in the one colour, you know, colour which is...
We talked about synthetic urine and the reasons for it to be made. Why would you make synthetic sweat?
So synthetic sweat, and that's the part of the clocking off show, synthetic sweat is used in factories or in the places where they test how human toxicity would make a mark on the garment or on the watch or something. So you basically use it just to check how, for example, it would go into your armpits, or if the watch would discolor and stuff like that. So there's a mixture of this kind of, you know, there's ammonia in it, there is urea in it, there is some kind of sodium kind of elements and the kind of human hormones that basically react on the fabric. So it's basically...
What other synthetic thing? Is this synthetic saliva and synthetic...
Well, I mean, there's something actually which I'm working on at the moment. Well, and it's available everywhere. It's synthetic milk, and I'm working on the show. Which is formula. That's a synthetic milk. You know what you're giving to the children. I'm working on a public commission. I'm working on a sculpture commission for Kunsthalle Vienna for the show in November, and I'm gonna have sculptures that are frozen synthetic milk that kind of slowly going into through the works. And the show is all about, you know, the breasts, the nipples, and we're looking at the kind of idea of the kind of the queer parenting and how the things are kind of changing and shifting. And anyways, that's a new body of work, so you know, let's not speak about it yet.
Vienna, what a place to show. How exciting.
Really excited. Yeah.
The work sounds delicious.
Yeah,
what is the best advice that you've ever received when it comes to your art, your work?
I'm gonna blank on that. Actually, I've got it. this is so completely shouldn't be said on the talk show like this. But that was the legend that is Lucy Gunning, who was my teacher at my BA, and she told me after I did the presentation of the work, she said to me like, just don't talk too much.
At the end of the talk right episode, the advice you've received. I disagree with that, because I think you're very articulate.
She was like,
just let the work do its thing.
That was funny.
I disagree with her completely. Yeah. I think you've been incredible on this episode.
Cheers, thank you.
So Freeze is coming up. Are you showing anything? Is Jonathan showing anything? Do you have plans for Freeze?
I mean, like, you know, the queer circle is open, so I think that's my main kind of, you know, it's free. And so basically, I've got kind of people planned to come and show around my show, you know, and I think that's the thing. And John, John just had a opening in Yorkshire Sculpture Park, then in Charleston, new space. So, I think we're both kind of having this post-show kind of slump at the moment now, you know? What does it feel like? It just feels, you know, it's like having a kind of calm down from a big partying, you know? It's just like you're running out of this kind of steam and happy feeling store, and then you start picking and nitpicking everything, and you kind of start hating everything, and, you know, but it takes like a week or so to get out of it, you know? So you need to be kind on yourself, yeah. Mm.
Well, luckily your show runs until the 26th of November, so there's still time for you to...
Where is Queer Circle located,
around.
Rob?
North Greenwich.
And then
is the closest tube, and you can also get buses there, and it's very easily accessible.
There's parking. You've also released your first, well, you're going to release your first edition that's going to be part of, with Queer Circle, that's going to be part of the Frieze Art Fair in the editions section. What is this edition? Let's talk about that quickly before we...
Okay, so edition is called The Hours Have Lost Their Clock, and it's being kind of titled after a book by Grafton Tanner about nostalgia. And so basically the edition is, there's 12 pieces. They are those little miniature figurines of the Sisyphus that you see in a space. And each of them got a different number of the hour on this chest. So it goes from 1 to 12. And they are in a bronze matte ceramic with a copper patina plate on their chest, with my favorite color on the chest, yes.
Well, so. Everyone try and... That's going to support Queer Circle. So everybody, if you are there, pick one of these up.
What's the edition size?
Size. You mean like size?
Yeah, how many?
Oh, it's 12 then.
12, oh, 12. 12 and two APs or something, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, no, they're beautiful. I love them. Well, thank you. This has just been
wonderful.
I've really, really
enjoyed
it.
We love you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and I think everybody listening is going to fall in love with you and go and check out your show.
Cool. And you're on Instagram, aren't you? And you've got your own amazingly detailed website, which I adore.
Thank you.
Which is just your name with a hyphen in the middle. So RafaelZaiko.com.
That is RafaelZaiko. Well, thank you. Everybody listening, we'll be posting pictures.
Yeah, thank you.
Of all the work we've been discussing today. And yes, please, everybody get down to Frieze and enjoy that and get down to Queer Circle and embrace that and love everyone.
We'll be back very soon. Thanks Big for love. Listening.
Bye,
thank
everyone.
You, Raph.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.